That is, do you remember a couple of years ago, there was this thing called a clear card you can sign up for to jump into the front of the airport security lines?
Sure.
Yeah, that's that. This here is the chip inside of it. And one of my recent hobbies, open those chips. Jump this over. So this is the chip as a whole. Zoom out. You can actually see this chip through the clear plastic of the card. And if you zoom in the corner here, you see up top where it says T023M, and beside that where you see Philips 2004. If you Google for this, you find this great official report that says, hackers will never be able to tell that we use the Philips P5CT054 because on the die it only says T023M. Google is awesome. My talk itself is about hacking these things. It's a remote radio quiz rating dealy used by undergrad classrooms. So if you all were in my class and I was too lazy to grade papers by hand, instead I could have each of you purchase one of these for $40 or $50 in the university bookstore, and then you push a button as class begins to answer a quiz that's displayed on the projector. Is then a receiver which can be plugged into the computer, which receives the radio signals, grades the students, and shoves those grades into an Excel table without the instructor having to do anything. But chip photographs are nice and fun, so we'll waste another minute or two with them. This is from an Iron Man toy. Can we cut the top lights?
Probably not on switches.
Okay, so this is from a children's toy for infrared text messaging. So you can type in your message in one unit, hit play, and it transmits it by infrared to another unit that receives it. The only writing on this chip is, find it, over here in the corner. It's 2826. Barely see it. I'm trying to actually read the memory of this visually to identify what type of chip this is. So if the program memory decodes properly as 8051 machine language, I know that it's an 8051 chip. If it works as 6502, I know that it's 6502 assembly. And memory, if I open one of those up, just going to do this chip. This here is 1 kilobyte of ROM. Each one of these columns is another bit of significance. So if we assume that this is the most significant bit, then this would be the middle bits, and this would be the least significant bit. The bits of significance are separated into different columns, because whereas when reading something on paper, you want it all to be jammed together, so you read one letter at a time. The computer wants them to be as far apart as possible so that it can fetch 16 bits at once, instead of having to read them sequentially and then decode them.
How do those columns translate into ones and zeros?
If I zoom in, you see these little pits?
Yes.
Yeah, so every dot is a zero, and the absence of a dot is a one.
Oh, okay. Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, the previous picture said the only writing was that number there. How did you find that looking through the entire picture, you have some text?
So I take these pictures through a metallurgical microscope after removing the lid of the chip with high-strength nitric acid. So I boil nitric acid, I drop the chip into it, the packaging comes apart, then I clean the chip off. Then I drop it under the microscope and I take 30 to 100 photographs of it, which I then combine with Panorama software. So as I'm doing that, I have to cover every piece of the surface area of the chip and I have to focus on it. And in doing this, I'm forced to see the entire chip. So if there's writing, I find it. If you find any other writing on that image, please let me know.
Couldn't you just like, I don't know the correct Photoshop term, but like enter all the colors or something like that? So we like, sometimes writing chops up in that case? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Part of the problem is that the colors are all stretched together. The brightest point isn't much brighter than the dimmest point.
Okay.
And there's chromatic aberration, so you actually get a much cleaner image if you look only at red, or only at blue, or only at green, than if you look at all three combined.
So the blue and the purple up there, that's something that you actually put in because that was the best?
No.
If you actually looked at it with the naked eye, first of all, you probably wouldn't be able to see nearly that much detail. But would it appear blue?
No. So I dropped a blue filter into my light source. So this is what the photograph looks like under blue light. There are still three components of light here, but if, especially in the Masteron photo, I've taken this in blue and green, you get the highest contrast on the individual dots if you look at it, if you look at the blue channel. Sorry, the green channel. So the blue channel, none of this detail shows up, and under the red channel, it shows up, but it's a bit blurry. And I focused with all three colors, so I don't know whether this is because the detail exists most in green, or if because green being brighter to the human eye than red, I focused on the green more than the red, as the human being operating the thing. That's that. Conferences. Okay. Just to give me a feel of the audience, how many of you know at least one assembly language? Okay, good. And how many of you have never done anything with electronics? No Arduino, no nothing. Okay. This is not my remote. I should have written a... Okay. Can I safely walk with this? This is not the part of the part. Alright. So this is a clicker. It's an audience response system used for quiz grades in undergraduate classrooms. The student will purchase this unit. I have a laser pointer. They'll purchase this unit and then type in the serial number seen on the left. That's the 15791B. Those are 3 bytes presented as hexadecimal.
I got one right here. Can't find it.
Okay. Oop. My battery's dead. Yes. Okay, we're good. So this is the serial number. And then there's a block of buttons here. And there's a very complicated procedure by which you can change this to another frequency, which in practice is never used. So this will always run at 1.441 gigahertz. And the there's no menus, there's no interaction. You just push a button and it broadcasts a signal. So the student gets no indication as to whether or not his bid has been accepted, other than a red light or a green light it comes on here. This is a tricolor LED. So there's red, green, and blue. To open this, you peel off the faceplate in the same way that you pull any sticker off. These buttons here are made of two contacts that run next to each other but don't quite overlap. And then the buttons have a bit of conductive ink just in the middle so that when they're physically pressed down, it bridges the contact and makes the switch connect. Some of them use the Nintendo tri-ring screws, others use standard Phillips. There are two ways to do it. You should have three or four of these screwdrivers in your collection.
I have one that's almost completely useless now because it was so crappily made.
Well, so I did that. I said, I'm never going to get stuck without a tri-ring screwdriver again. I bought five of them. And I found myself needing a Phillips screwdriver of that exact size and not being able to find one.
Nice.
Another trick that you can do is you can take a Bic pen and you can melt it. Well, you can do it with a cigarette lighter, but it's better to do it with a heat gun. Then as it's liquid, squish it down on top. Wow. Wait for it to cool, and then you can twist it. In any case, when it's open, you can begin to identify the parts. And basically, you just Google the model numbers of the devices that you see. In the case of that Iron Man toy, where I had to take photographs of the chip die, and even then I couldn't identify it, that's the exception rather than the rule. In this case, this is a Nordic RF 24E10. This is an 8051 microcontroller and a 2.4 GHz radio in a single package. What it does not have is permanent storage, because it's one complicated analog process to make flash memory, and it's another complicated analog process to make a radio chip. It takes a couple of generations for a semiconductor company to combine them into a single part. Because of that, all of the program memory is held in this chip off to the side. And this is a regular spy ROM that you can read and write with an Arduino. So it's just the radio chip, the boot ROM, and there are no other chips of significance on the board. This is a power supply. You've got a 16 megahertz crystal for the radio. But there are no other chips worth messing with. You can grab by Google the documentation for each one of these chips from its manufacturer. The boot ROM 24C32 is perfectly standardized. You could swap it out from a competing vendor, the exact same chip would fit in the exact same spot. Every pin's location is stamped on that chip. As for the Nordic RF microcontroller and radio, it is not quite so standardized, but 8051 is the most popular computer in the world. You probably have a few dozen within your cell phone. I guarantee you that you have at least a dozen within your home computer. Within each laptop, every USB device seems to include an 8051 somewhere. Which means that there are lots of tools for taking apart 8051 software. And the boot ROM is unprotected. You can just connect to it and download a copy of its contents onto your computer, then start messing with it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So what would a protected boot ROM look like? Would it just be like physically inaccessible?
A protected boot ROM would either be encrypted with the key that was burned into the target chip, or on this scale, they would just put flash memory inside of the microcontroller chip and protect it with a flash. I've written some articles that you can find on my blog for how to get around that.
Well, there's some chips where you can just make it so that you can't read it back out after you burn it, right?
Yes, but you can get around that. For example, the...
Well, I know there was somewhere, like, if you gave them, like half the power supply or something, you could fake them out to get it to...
Yeah.
Like, in the later stuff that they developed, they haven't really fixed it.
There are other things, though. On the MSP430, I break those by removing the lid with nitric acid and hitting them with a camera flash while I'm trying to repeatedly enter with the debugger. The camera flash is enough to knock all of the transistors out of whack, including the one flip-flop that's one way if it allows access and the other way if it doesn't.
That's kind of arcane knowledge right there.
To do this, I had to spend 6 months of my life writing a debugger for that chip.
Hey.
But now that I've done it, I can break a chip in 6 hours. The radio chip has a 1 Mbps GFSK radio. It does 2.4 to 2.5 gigahertz with 1 MHz even spacing per channel. It has to boot from the external boot ROM. It has no code of its own except for a ROM bootloader inside. And then all the ROM bootloader does is copy the external software into its own RAM. GFSK is a popular encoding mechanism, so I'm using another Nordic RF chip to sniff this protocol. But you could do it with a GNU radio or with another radio chip of the same frequency if you like. So once again, this is the radio, this is the boot ROM. To dump it, you just need to know which command has to be sent. And in SPI, everything is bidirectional. So every time you send a byte, you are also receiving a byte at the same time. This is because you have one clock line with two data lines. So the host transmits the byte 3, followed by the low byte of the address, and then the high byte of the address, and then a 0. This value is actually ignored, it could be anything, to the memory chip. The memory chip replies with 3 bytes of nonsense that are ignored, followed by the byte that was requested. You just have to play this through an Arduino, or in my case, I wrote a driver for the GoodFET, which is a USB to anything adapter that I maintain. I have extra boards for the GoodFET that I'll pass out here if you'd like them. The GoodFET allows you to write client software in Python on the host in order to get it working, and then you move it into C running on the GoodFET itself when and only when you need performance. Because this chip is so small and because I don't have to rewrite it very often, it was perfectly acceptable to write the driver entirely within Python. This means that it takes me a minute instead of a second to dump the chip, but I can grab a coffee and wait. And all I'm doing here is sending the read command, which is 3, followed by the low byte of the address, followed by the high, byte of the address, then the low, than the byte itself. I think the addresses were flipped by the radio chip, but this is the correct direction. And then I just return the 4th byte that it gives me back. This allows me to create a dump of memory chip. Inside of the dump, as bytes 3, 4, and 5, I see 15791B. 15791B. So these 3 bytes are the serial number that's written on the back of the package. If you change these bytes and write it back in, even though you don't understand the rest of the memory yet, this is sufficient to change the serial number of a device and impersonate a classmate. The 8051 code begins on the 7th byte here with 020AB7. This is like a jump to the real entry point. But it's this point that gets loaded to address 0 within the RAM of the microcontroller. So everything before byte 7 can just be thought of as configuration data or a header. And this 7 here actually tells the chip which byte to jump to begin copying into internal memory, as well as how many pages. So 0B is the number of pages, and 07 is the starting point. Once I've dumped it to a file and I cut out the first 7 bytes, I load it into IDAPRO starting at address 0. IDAPRO is an interactive disassembler. It allows you to view a computer program starting with what the machine has and then annotate it until it's human readable. There are only 3 kilobytes of code within this program. I think the average number of bytes per instruction is 2 or 3. So we're talking 1,000 to 1,500 words of code, which is nothing. And this is a complete graph of every function within the device. I began by identifying the serial port receive and transmit instruction, which is this one. And then I started looking at the functions that called it. So this one here pokes a value in the spy prop. This is used to write back the new channel after the channel has been reconfigured. Going higher up, you see things like a radio setup a radio setup function. This is how I figure out which channel the radio is broadcasting on. I actually figured out the channel, packet length, encoding, and checksumming before ever turning on a radio. It could all be figured out black box. So inside of this device, how am I on time?
20 minutes.
Okay, so inside this device, there's no operating system. There's no Linux, there's no Windows, there's no room for anything like that. There are also no function symbol names. If you take apart PC software, you can identify every external function that gets imported. So wherever a DLL is used, you can get the name of every DLL function. You cannot do the same thing in an embedded application because it has no need to dynamically link. Therefore, it doesn't include any linking information at all. But I/O ports do have names. If you're taking apart an Arduino program and a byte is written out to a port, the way that looks at the lowest level is that an address has a value written into it. And that address is the memory mapped I/O port of, say, a series of pins on the port. It's the same thing here, except that all of the radio equipment is also identified. And you can look up example functions to compare them to the ones that you find within the firmware. So this is a function that I've annotated which exchanges SPI bytes. So you call this function with one byte of input, it transmits that byte out and returns to you the byte that it read back in. The way that IDA works, you choose a name. So spy data is an I/O port. This began as just the address at which spy data existed. By right-clicking on it and assigning it a name, or by clicking once and hitting end, you give it a new name which gets carried through the entire document, so that every other instance of it gets renamed. And that's how you annotate a complete program. And if you want to grab the slides later and read through it, all it's doing is transmitting the one byte by writing it out to a port. Then it continuously checks a status register to see that the incoming byte is ready. And when it's ready, it returns it. Now, inside of the chip, the Nordic RF2041, this is the radio plus microcontroller, they didn't even have time to combine the registers of the two. So inside of this chip, one component speaks to the other over a serial port. So this serial exchange function that was identified earlier, this is sufficient to figure out all of the radio stuff. Because there's a Nordic RF2401 radio transceiver on the side of the chip that all of this data bounces back and forth with. So if you look at the transmission functions and you read the bytes that are being transmitted, you'll start to recognize command codes for the radio. There are all sorts of registers you can look for. The radio is at 80 hex. Bit 3 of that is radio slave select. That's how you choose the radio. Bit 7 is power up. This is how the radio is turned on to make a transmission and then turned off when it's done. And things like this are done for power management reasons. The turning point clicker runs on 2 coin cell batteries. And students aren't likely to replace them if they don't know that the device is dead. There's also an LED port. It's very easy to identify that something is blinking the red LED or blinking the green LED, and by that you can figure out whether the piece of code you're in is a success condition or an error condition. Uh, The two spy ports are used differently, only in the beginning and ending. So if you want to talk to the external EEPROM, you lower the wire that selects that, and then you send your data, and then you raise it back. You do the exact opposite for the radio, in that you raise the radio enable line, send your commands back and forth, and then lower it. So by doing this, if you have a function that uses the serial port, you can figure out which device the serial port is speaking to. Once you have these, you can start recognizing where functions are. This is the function which sets up the radio. And you can see it writing the configuration here. So this is a trial function that actually sets up the frequency, the packet length, and every other configuration. It does this just by a bunch of functions that write out. So the first one, these first two lines say transmit an 8. The second two say transmit an 8. These say transmit a 0, 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 all the way down to transmit a 1B. These are the bytes as they come out. 1B is followed by 1C, 1D, and so forth. But these are global variables, not values. These three bytes are where the target address of the receiver is stored. This is the full radio configuration layout as is described in the radio datasheet. If you just write the bytes in order here, starting with the end and working your way back up, you can figure out what each field means. Which one is the destination address, which one is the source address. So this says that the MAC address is at 1B, 1C, 1D, that there are 4 bytes of data in each packet, and a single byte checksum. Then there are these repeated calls to the transmission function. This is the destination address at 1E, 1F, 120, and the 1B, 1C, 1D is the source address. So it turns out that every one of these devices is transmitting first the target address that it's broadcasting to. That's the address of the receiver. If you have these three numbers and nothing else, well, these three numbers are the channel, then you're able to receive packets. This is the closest thing to a password that the network has. And then these three are the three bytes and serial number that you see in the sticker on the back, I showed you at the beginning. Then this input byte, that's the ASCII code of the button that is physically being pressed. So if you search for the destination MAC address, you find that they're just copying the numbers 12, 34, 56. The secret password is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
It's the code of my luggage.
That won't stop TSA from breaking the law. So I wrote this dandy little application that runs in this device. It's the Badger designed for the Next Hope conference. 1,800 of these were manufactured and distributed. And on any one of these, you can add a single chip and a USB plug to the back, plug it into your computer, reflash it with new firmware, run this Python script, and start catching packets out of the ether. This says that student 1F8760 pressed the number 5. 35 is the ASCII code for the symbol 5. This is the hardware that I used. I have my own microcontroller, but here on the right, I used the Nordic RF24L01 Plus. It's a more advanced radio. Supports a faster data rate, lower power, things like that. But I just purchased all of the parts from this on the open market, and then I soldered them onto the board. The white ones that came later were mass-produced, but this was entirely handmade. This is the design. You can kind of see the blue is the back of the board, red is the front. You can sort of see the USB plug here on the back, USB chip on the back. Then the bigger chip in the foreground is the microcontroller of my design. And this over here is the radio. In the back, here's the USB plug, USB chip. These two parts were available in a kit for $20. You can buy the parts itself for significantly less than that. Solder them up and have some fun. So inside of it, I used a more powerful microcontroller, a more powerful radio. This microcontroller can be programmed through GCC. It's a 16-bit RISC processor, so you just download the right target of GCC. I built all of the firmware using Emacs, Make, and GCC. All of the code is available at nhbadge.sf.net, including all of the hardware, so you can remanufacture these yourself. By reflashing the conference badge, which was originally intended to broadcast by radio the position of every attendee, using the OpenBeacon firmware. So as you're walking through the Hotel Pennsylvania during the conference, your position is being tracked and sent through power over USB, sorry, power over Ethernet, to aggregation points that combine it into a server. You could do HTTP queries to figure out where a particular friend of yours was. This was a lot of fun. The radio settings are different for the two projects, but not that much. My secret code for the Hope conference was 1, 2, 3, 2, 1. A little bit longer. And I used a different checksum length. But in any case, if you put these values into the packet snipper, you can catch packets from the conference itself. And just to make things more fun, I disabled cryptography on the OpenBeacon port. So people were reprogramming their badges to impersonate each other. It was a doppelganger badge, and if you push the button on the badge when you're standing next to someone, it identifies that, copies his MAC address, and from then on, both positions exist within the database. A complete packet capture, it's 8 gigabytes of every single packet that went over the radio network, is available by BitTorrent now, and you can work backward through it and separate the doppelgangers from the original people. Client's all Python, and everything is a register when doing this. So in order to talk to the radio, I'm just writing a pure Python client in the same way that I wrote one for the memory chip. To set the frequency, all I do is put the channel number into memory at address 5. Address 5 is the register. So you can imagine that there's just this bunch of global variables which control the radio settings.
Shit.
Should just be the projector, right?
Yeah, that's fine. So, do you have any questions before the projector comes back? None at all?
Is that the next whole plan? Is that just for fun? Is that just something that they do at the con just for fun? Or?
Yeah. I had Texas Instruments donate the microcontrollers. At the last Hope, the same positioning application was done. But I wanted the next Hope badge to be sort of hackable, so that you could add extra features to it or do something interesting with it. If you have a next Hope badge and you add the USB port, you can not only use it for packet sniffing radio, but you can also use it to read and write memory chips. You can rewrite the BIOS chip on a PC through it. Physically remove the DIP chip from your computer, flywire it up, and flash a new boot image in your computer. Oh, that was cool. It had the last image remaining in its memory. But it had degraded because the memory chip didn't have power. That's why it was speckled. People think that if you take power away from battery, if you take power away from a RAM chip, it forgets its state instantly. But in the case of DRAM, it actually takes a while to do that.
Yeah, there are people like throw liquid nitrogen or like other sort of probably not liquid nitrogen, but like
stuff to keep it cool so that they have longer to read it off before
the game. Right. The other interesting part is that ones will fall to zeros, but zeros will never fall to ones. So if you're trying to recover a cryptographic key, anything that shows up as a one, you know for a fact used to be a one. But things that show up as a zero might have been one way or might have been the other.
I have one question.
Yes.
So what else have you heard of people doing with these badges post-conference? Like, what is the one that made you the happiest?
My favorite was a Geiger counter that had a badge wired into it as a receiver. And the needle would swing with proximity to a badge. So you could wander around the conference, there's radioactivity somewhere, and let me check you, and then as you physically swing it toward the person, the needle swings. You don't believe me? Try it yourself. I like the doppelganger one, and afterwards, I've had a couple of people who hacked their badges since joining the GoodFet project, the USB memory rewriter thing that I do. This toy is also a lot of fun. It's the Girl Tech IME. You can buy these for $15 on Amazon.com. You can reprogram them in the same way that you can the Turning Point device, except that they have a full LCD. My girlfriend and I are working on a zombie game for this. But it also has a radio in it. So Michael Osman took a development kit that I posted for the device, and he built a spectrum analyzer for it. So you can actually see the key within the AT&T band as an iPhone is transmitting. I'll power this up and show it off afterward. This is the upgrade port for the IME. It's just beneath the batteries. It's a popular place to put it because the battery panel is the last thing attached to the factory. So it's easy to leave it off before running them all through a programming station. And programming these things is rather labor intensive. Have a guy sitting physically pressing it down, hitting a button on the keyboard, and then he comes back to, or he watches it become flashed and he looks for an error message. I did the same thing on the Next Hope Badge production line. This is how I know that the Windows XP has really crappy Chinese support. So if you have a Python application that works perfectly in Unix displaying Chinese instructions next to English ones on the command line, there is no chance in hell that it will work in cmd.exe halfway around the world. And whenever you get an error message like that, it takes 24 hours to try again. Because you wind up missing the workday. During the batch manufacturing, I wound up on call from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. for quite a bit longer than I would have liked. So you can just Dremel it out and flywire it on. The soldering doesn't have to be very clean. This is the first one that I tapped into. So over here, I've got a GoodFet, and then this is the IME with the quartz coming out. You can see it's still running the old software. This is Mike's spectrum analyzer. You can track down radio transmitters. At the Embedded Systems Conference in Chicago, I used this to find someone who was broadcasting 15 watts on a 950 megahertz. So that radio receivers that were nearby, 10, 15 feet away, could charge themselves by the radio signal and run entirely without a battery or solar power. This is an electric water meter that I might or might not have stolen from the French water system. So in Paris, they've got lots of water pipes, and it's handy to know which of them are leaking. So what you do is you put a volume meter at different spots within the pipelines, and then a device like this can wirelessly transmit how much water is going. It can also receive that from nearby units and rebroadcast them so that you can read an entire neighborhood from one position. The same thing is being done with the smart electric grid. So instead of having a meter band come across and physically measure your meter, instead a radio signal can be transmitted, which is passed down the line to some electric meter somewhere that also has a cell phone.
How does this relate to like gas sensing or thermostats or other things? Because I know they're doing wireless mesh systems for those.
The technology is the same. The only difference is that you have a lot less electricity available with gas and water measurement than you do with electric. So generally, the cryptography is bad in electric meters and non-existent in other types of meters. I've been meaning to take apart the ANT protocol. If any of you have seen these exercise watches that can communicate with your Nike shoes and so forth, they use the same chips as the Next Hope badge. So it's possible to packet sniff and inject these things, but it hasn't yet been reverse engineered. Like no one is able to tell you, so far as I've been able to find, which frequency it uses or what the destination address is by default. If you have any of this ANT equipment, please let me know. There are also neat tricks that you can use when breaking one of these chips. For example, all of the Ember 200 series chips that were used in early smart grid equipment, they expose all of their memory to a debugger. So if you find, say, a thermostat with one and you want a copy of its firmware or a copy of its keys, you can just buy a device from the manufacturer and plug up to it to do that. And there's no locking mechanism that can prevent you having access. Every ChipCon 851 radio, that's the microcontroller that are used in this device, they all expose their RAM to the debugger even though they protect flash. So you can connect to the IME and say erase everything. It erases all of its memory, but only its flash memory. It leaves RAM intact. Then you can copy RAM back out, and along with RAM, the radio control registers are protected. So you're able to determine what the last frequency it was tuned to, and what the last packet length was, what the last encoding was, write that back into a new setting, and you're able to packet it. With the smart grid, there's this product tie-in where your thermostat can connect to your electric meter, so that your thermostat would tell you how much electricity you would use during the day. So if you're running the air conditioning or not running the air conditioning, you'll have some concept of how much that affects your electric bill without waiting until the end of the month. The random number generators in all of these devices were bad, and the cryptographic protocol that they used, instead of RSA, was ECMQV, which exposes the private keys whenever the random number generators are bad. So you can actually build a 20 megabyte lookup table of every public key to every private key, and then do a search to work your way backward. Reprogramming a device is almost always allowed, so even if you can't figure out what used to be in it, it's not very hard to write new software that runs in it, like the Spectrum Analyzer or a zombie game. In the case of the IME, these two commands erase the device's flash memory and then copy all of its RAM out even when it begins as being locked. And these are just Unix commands that go to Python scripts. So goodfet.cc is just a Python client. That's all I have time for. All right, thank you kindly.